Welcome, people of Zen, to the Zen Hall of Light. As I recall, once a long time ago, in a universe far, far away, Yoda Zenji said something like, "Beings of light are we, not mere mortal flesh and blood beings." Something like that. I can't remember his quote exactly. We're exploring the light, the Sesshin, radiant light. Dogen Zenji wrote an essay called Radiant Light, which we looked into this practice focus. We didn't quite make it to the end. At the very end, Dogen usually writes, they usually call a colophon. I don't know what a colophon is, but something like a little concluding statement about when he wrote it and where he wrote it, usually. So at the end of this Shobo Genzo Komyo, Radiant Light, it's just a colophon. It's really like this extra additional thing. But long ago when I first read this essay, somehow this colophon stuck with me. Because usually he just writes, this was taught at this place and this date. So this colophon says, this essay was presented to the assembly at Kanon Dori Kosho Horinji at the fourth section of the third watch of the night. So sometimes there'd be Dharma talks like in the middle of the night at Koshoji. This was in the middle of night. Dogen taught this essay on light. That itself, I think, is beautiful. He taught it on the second day, the sixth month, in the third year of the Ninji era, 1242. And then he goes on, which usually would stop there, but the colophon goes on. Dogen says, at that time, it had been raining for a long time. It was the rainy season in Japan. And raindrops kept dripping endlessly under the eaves. What is this radiant light? Which Zen ancestor Yunmen asked earlier in this essay, what is this light that all of us are? It had been raining for a long time and the raindrops kept dripping endlessly under the eaves. What is this radiant light? The assembly must look and break through Yunmen's words. Or another translation is, the assembly could not help being pierced by Yunmen's words. Yes.
Yeah. So these eaves, is this a reference to another story? I know the chant that we have in the evening is to sit grandly under the eaves.
Yeah. It may be a reference to this colophon. Yeah, Edjo was there, yeah. And I've wondered that too, and it's in quotation marks in the chant. So, to be honest, I actually don't know. But it has a nice ring to it. And the image when we chant that, and I hear that is this my imagination is night sitting at Koshoji or Dogen's temple outside on the Engawa, the walkway around the Zendo, under these large overhanging eaves that Japanese temples have, and where the rain just, there's no gutters, it just drips all down, and hopefully not right on where people are sitting, but that's my imagination.
I almost saw this as like a Zazen instruction, eavesdropping.
No.
Like watching thoughts but not being involved.
Mm.
But you're still right there listening to every word.
Interesting. Well, there we go. That's what's great about a cryptic sentence like that. Just sit grandly under the eaves. Under the eaves of light where the raindrops keep dripping endlessly. So all yesterday, especially at night when the raindrops are falling, the Zendo seems so luminous to me. Yeah. And there's drop after drop, the sound of the rain. Exquisite. So, yesterday this issue came up about experience, which from time to time, such an issue comes up. Kind of like, dare we say, enlightenment, experience. We try to avoid the word. It's experience. Can you have an experience of the light? And I hesitate a bit to get into this, but the impulse arises to try to explore this with you because if it not during Sesshin, then when else could we explore such a thing? So just that, you know, that conversation percolated in my mind how can we, what is this that we're talking about here, this whole enlightenment business? Because I think we usually, our conceptual understanding usually falls into these two sides. Either one extreme of like, there is this enlightenment experience, it's something that happens that I will know kind of as an objective experience, and of course I want to get that. That's one side, it's kind of a trap. And the other extreme is it can't be an experience. It can't be some objective thing. So so there's nothing to say about it or to know about it. So just like kind of just be here and just be here. And forget about this enlightenment business. And then what happens is maybe we just are just being here and thinking, well, there's not really something anyway. And then we, at least when I fall into this extreme, then my habitual mind of just like, well, I'm just sort of biding my time and being present, enjoying the present, but kind of neglecting the issue of Buddha's great awakening. See how those can both be kind of traps, these two extremes. And maybe we could roughly say that the first one is kind of like the Rinzai trap, and the second one's kind of the Soto trap. And both of them potentially could miss the great joy and ease of Buddha's awakening. So, part of the risk of talking about this is it's very hard to talk about, and so can easily get trapped in words, but this is an attempt to try to articulate this matter. First of all, as I said yesterday, I would define experience as an event, a happening, in a particular time and place that is known by experiencing. Therefore, it's an object of thought. At least it's an object of perception. So therefore, there's duality involved inherently, I would say. If we're talking about an experience, it's something dualistically known by a subject. So that's why if we define experience this way, then I would propose there's no such thing as an enlightenment experience. So, well, what about what happened to Buddha? So that's why I do like the way that Dogen, one of his favorite words, he hardly ever talks about, he does sometimes talk about, say, like, Satori or Kensho. Like, these are okay, too, but they maybe imply more an experience. Dogen's favorite word around this enlightenment business is this Japanese word sho, that means to verify or confirm or even prove, could be translated. And we often translate it as realization, which is okay too, but it's more literally like to verify or confirm. In Dogen's famous teaching, practice and realization are not two. The realization here is show. So I think more literally it's like practice and verification or confirmation are not two. So then we have the question, is this confirmation or verification just another experience? And I would say no, not necessarily. It doesn't have to be a known event, known as an experience by the experiencing. So, a couple of stories that I think Zen metaphors that try to get at this issue of confirmation. One of them's in this essay of Ejo, and one of them's Dogen brings up sometimes, like in the Bendo-wa. So Dogen's, that he says, metaphor is, it's like drinking water and knowing for yourself whether it's hot or cold. So he talks about this verification. And the one that Ejo brings up, that is also in the Mumon Kan and other places, is it's like meeting your father or mother in a busy marketplace and recognizing them and this crowd of people immediately. And then he says, no one needs to tell you that that's your mother or father. It's like a direct verifying. So these are two metaphors. The water's cool. And you kind of know generally what that means. So, but if you didn't know the experience of temperature, it would be very hard to describe what cool means, wouldn't it? So I think that's why these two metaphors are kind of nice. That same thing, if there's a sea of faces, and there's your mother, and, oh, there's my mother, I recognize her immediately, and your friend standing next to you who's never met your mother, you say, see, that one there. Say, which one? They all look the same to me. The one that's kind of like, you know, blonde hair. Well, there's a lot of them with blonde hair. And, you know, it's so obvious, don't you see? it's my mother. I'm like, no, I've never seen your mother. I don't know what she looks like. So I think in that way, these two metaphors are kind of nice because they also, both of them are not a conceptual idea, right? They're a direct sensory experience of knowing temperature and knowing this face that's very familiar. So they're non-conceptual, but the metaphors, both of those metaphors, I say, fall a little short, like most metaphors actually do in the end. Because though they are non-conceptual, we could say, they're direct sensory experience, they're still, I would say, dualistic in the sense that, like, the temperature is an experience. They're experiences. And seeing my mother in the marketplace is still an experience. The way we defined experience as something that is known by experiencing an object that is known by a subject. I think that's where those metaphors fall short. They follow so far. But they're still pretty good in that they're emphasizing a non-conceptual and also, I would say, kind of ineffable or very hard to describe experience. I think that's what the metaphors are getting at. So we could say, well, how could it possibly be possible to have a kind of verification or confirmation that is both non-conceptual, like drinking water, that's pretty easy to see, but how about non-conceptual and non-dual, meaning like a verification of something that's not an experience? And I would propose this is possible. And here's the example. This is not, by the way, about enlightenment. So this is just one example that I think we can try out right now to kind of get in the mood or to confirm that it's possible to confirm a reality that's not conceptual or not dualistic. The confirmation is non-conceptual and non-dualistic. And it's something very, very ordinary. So, you know, try this out. And excuse me for those who've already tried this out many times. The method to enter this particular non-conceptual, non-dual confirmation, it comes in a conceptual package. I would say all methods are conceptual. Even to say, sit upright and drop off body and mind, that's conceptual instruction. But the conceptual instruction and conceptual method takes us, hopefully, to a non-conceptual place. So here's the conceptual words. The method is a question to ask yourself. Am I aware right now? Is awareness present right now? That's a conceptually packaged instruction. But to follow the ask the question deeply and sincerely, seems to take us to this place where there is a confirmation. Is awareness present right now for you? We're not talking about enlightenment or anything here. We're just talking about regular old, like, presence of awareness. We are knowing experience right now. There is experiencing happening right now. Yeah? So I'd say, when you check for yourself and you can say yes, maybe in a way, when we say yes, it's a kind of conceptualized after effect. because it's a word that's relative to know. But just before the word comes, when we first check, and we see, it's like the most obvious thing, right? Yeah, of course. I'm aware. Of course there's experiencing going on. That's what I would call verification, confirmation. And it's both non-conceptual. It's like, we don't have to be convinced that we're aware right now. It's non-conceptual. And I would say it's a non-dual confirmation. Again, this is not enlightenment. This is just a mundane example of non-conceptual, non-dual verification that we can all, everybody, can access. And it's a little bit unusual. I actually can't think of many other examples, any really, that fit into this category of non-conceptual, non-dual verification. The other example I can think of is what I would call enlightenment, which we'll get to later. But for now, can you follow so far?
Yeah, even if I said no, it's still like a confirmation. If I said yes, or if I said no, there's still like an epiphany or a eureka or something. And because I'm saying no, there's sort of like, well, I'm aware.
Yeah.
Your question is about awareness, so in a way, yes or no, I'm confirming. So
yeah.
Like conceptually.
Because you're aware of the word no or yes.
Yeah.
Like yes. It's undeniable, I would say. It's one of these, I think part of what verification and confirmation means is there's no doubt, not even like the tiniest trace of doubt. It's like it's so obvious and nobody could ever talk us out of it. Right? That's what Zen kind of confirmation or verification is about. Just like somebody in the marketplace, and they say, that's not really your mom. Well, fine, you can tell me that, but so what? Of course it's my mom. Or like, that water you're drinking is really hot. Fine, you can tell me that, but like, there's no doubt for me that it's cool water. So, those metaphors fall a little bit short, because then we could have this debate about, well, what exactly do we mean by hot and cold? It's kind of lukewarm water, right? So there's some debate, but whether we're present and aware right now, I think we could try to get into some debate about, well, it's not really awareness, but the awareness I'm speaking of is just the most obvious one. And it's non-conceptual because this awareness that we know is not a concept, just like tasting water, but it goes a step further than tasting water because it's not an experience, I would say. This verifying that we're aware right now, it's not an experience because, again, an experience is something that can be grasped as an object of thought or knowledge. This awareness is completely ungraspable. So if we try to confirm it as some object, which maybe we might try to do, like, is it a... Well, yeah, I know that awareness is present, but what is it? What is it? We cannot say really what it is. That's why Yuen Men said, everyone has a light, but when you look for it as an experience, you cannot see it, find it, and get a hold of it. If you try to get a hold of it in that way, it just becomes dark and obscure. Right? It cannot be objectified awareness. Right? I mean, as soon as we call it awareness, it kind of objectifies it. But the direct experience before the word awareness is, it's undeniable. I'm proposing this is how your experience is, as well as mine. Tell me if I'm wrong. It's undeniable. There's no doubt about it. It's verified and it's confirmed, but it's not a thing, it's not an object, and it's not an experience. In fact, it is experiencing. It is the source of all experiences. And if we make it even slightly into some kind of experience, then it just becomes an object of experiencing. It's not the experiencing itself. The experiencing itself is just radiant light. Everyone with me so far? Yes. No, to you first.
Would it be reasonable to say that the difference between experience and experiencing is the experience, there is still an awareness of self, and the experiencing, there is the self is dissolved?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, what we call subject and object in a normal experience. Like even tasting the water, I would say, oh yeah, I know there's an experiencer, it feels like, that knows that this is cold, that's registering, that's happening to me. And that would be like a subtle sense of self. There's somebody that it's happening to. Whereas, again, there might be just tasting water without the sense of a self, too. But with this awareness, there can never be a sense of a self that is experiencing it other than the awareness itself, right? That's why it's this unusual realm. It can never be, there's never one awareness aware of another awareness. There's only one awareness. So we could say, another question that can come up here is, well, who or what is it that's verifying that awareness is present? It's a good question to ask. In fact, it's a good follow-up question in this exercise after first asking, is awareness present? Yes, there's a total verification. And then the next question is, what is it that just verified that? What is it that is verifying it right now? What is it that confirms that awareness is present? What would you say to this one? I don't know, it's pretty good. Awareness. Yeah, just to finish this line of thought here. Awareness is verifying itself. How could there be somebody else verifying? If it seems that there is somebody else verifying, I would say that someone who's verifying is actually an object of awareness. We know that we're aware right now, and the we that knows that is awareness. So actually awareness is verifying itself. That's why we call it non-dual. It's not a subject verifying an object. Let this sink in. Yes.
Just for play's sake, artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence.
It can do all the things you're saying. It can recognize hot and cold.
Yes.
It can recognize its water.
Yes.
It can do all
yes.
these things.
Mm-hmm.
It can be reactions.
Yes.
So there's a subtle difference.
Mm-hmm.
That we might have to question about what's the difference between reaction and experience.
Yeah, maybe they're very similar. But what comes to mind when you bring up artificial intelligence, which is a nice thing to bring up in this conversation, is the difference between us and artificial intelligence. And maybe Arya can comment on this as a working in the computer realm. But what I would say is that, yes, our artificial intelligence can do a lot of these things that people can, it can do in a way, it can dualistic functions. It can know things. Even a camera can know an image of light and register that image, and similar to the way a dualistic mind can. But I would propose that however advanced technology gets, it will never be able to create an artificial intelligence with this non-dual knowing of itself. That's my proposal, that this is impossible.
So it's a binary, right? So the ones and zeros, almost like yin-yang, and
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But they're never like simultaneous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the unique thing about this light, is it cannot be created. If we could create it as artificial intelligence and we could construct radiant light, it would be a constructed phenomena. It's impossible. This radiant light is unconstructed, unconditioned, unmade, non-dual, non-conceptual, self-illuminating, which means self-verifying, endlessly and beginninglessly. Everyone with this so far? Yes?
Well, I just want to say what my experience, I mean, just the fact that I have to talk about it, means that I have to conceptualize.
Yeah, yeah.
But the first question, are you aware? I'm aware that my non-dual awareness that listens to the question, listens to your voice, this sort of energy that I've got is going out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that question immediately turns that energy around,
yeah,
and I go very close.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to do it very quickly and very automatically.
Yeah.
So that at the very least, I mean, just to sort of be like Richard, you know, not want to totally agree, but I do want to totally agree, but the experience of doing that exercise is that my aware energy is really very close.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do have to admit that the second question, which is how did you put it?
What is it that is verifying this awareness right now?
There's a little bit more, I do a little bit more searching.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
And I have to sort of,
yep. Uh-huh. I agree.
I have to say, you know, is this the Patrick that went to school? Is this the Patrick that does a lot of meditating? Is this a Patrick that's awake now and not so sleepy? You know, I have to sort of...
But maybe those are the ones verifying?
Yeah. I have to sort of...
Uh-huh.
I really think, is it really a person that...
It's not a person.
Verifies?
Yeah.
But I have to...
You have to check.
I have to go...
Yeah,
to
yeah,
home,
yeah.
Home,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Marks or the signs,
mm-hmm,
of what I think of as,
yeah,
as Patrick,
yeah,
sort of say, no, that's not what's, mm-hmm, verifying.
Nicely put. Yeah, yeah, I agree. So,
so there's a little bit more, you know,
there's a little
busy energy,
yeah,
kind of searching and,
mm-hmm,
and rejecting.
A little, we could say, a little bit of conceptual reasoning and investigation before we land again on a non-conceptual verification. That it must be awareness verifying itself. Yeah, and so both are conceptual instructions that lead there. This particular, which I think a lot, the best Zen instructions that all come packaged in words, are the ones that are that the words point. Take us away from an experience to the ungraspable experiencing. And so in a way the first one's more direct. The second one takes a little bit more conceptual searching to come to the conclusion. We could also, maybe it would be easier to say, like, after the first, like, confirmation comes, yes, awareness is present, like, to almost, like, right away say, like, how, you know, what is it that makes that yes so confident? Would be another way to ask it. And then it's not like, well, it's not like, couldn't be Patrick or Kokyo. It's like, it came, that the confirmation so clear and undeniable confirmation must have come not from my usual conceptual mind. So, but this is a, you know, that's a conceptual story too. Yes?
Yeah, I feel like this must be why people really enjoy sports. I say this to say that there's certain like non-dual communities that are starting to look at like professional athletes and flow states, you know, that they might get into, and seeing those as kind of like a non-dual aiming.
Uh-huh.
Right, because when you get these flows, like you ask a professional athlete, how did you sink 5 3-point shots in a row? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, there's like a confirmation.
Yeah.
Of course, it's I'm going to make this shot.
Yeah.
It's not like a, I'm going to do that. this is happening for me, it's just like this thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I think a lot of, you could say, Zen practice, especially in Sesshin, is so beautiful how it's designed to do all these activities. Some of them get kind of complicated, like do it, you know, putting on an Oryoki meal. Right? There's so much going on there. And yet I think it's to help us get into the flow state. And it takes a while to get so used to the form that we're not having to think about it, but still maintain this attention. And I think Sesshin also, it's striking me, the Sesshin, that movement between like really big, spacious, big mind in Zazen and then like having to do something particular. And it's training the flexibility of the mind to kind of maintain this doing something still in a kind of a flow without losing big mind, hopefully. And we're integrating back and forth. But it's challenging. Some people might find that just the sitting in silent openness more challenging because the chattering mind comes in more. I tend to find the getting involved in the details more challenging because it's hard. Like it's so the habitual self and other thing just like starts getting triggered so quickly and immediately as soon as something has to be done. So then this again, the non-conceptual, non-dual verification, then almost immediately, leaves a trace in the conceptual mind. Like, it might be just a little trace, like, is awareness present right now? You can feel the confirmation, confirm. And then, because it came in a conceptual question, the conceptual word comes out, yes. So now it's like, the yes is a slightly, like, added layer to the direct confirmation. And it's a word that we can then communicate to somebody else. It's kind of like communicating about this non-conceptual thing through this simple word, yes. And, you know, there's room for error there between the words and the directness. And then other layers can be added on, like, wow, actually, that's actually, this conceptual story might start growing now, like, that's, like, way cool that there can be a non-conceptual, non-dual verification in such an ordinary way. I never would have imagined such a thing until I actually just checked it out. And now this is all this conceptual kind of thing. And now we kind of have what we're calling an experience, right? And that we can remember that happened. And we can remember the conceptualized version of like, I just had a non-conceptual, non-dual confirmation at 9:47 on Saturday morning in the Santa Cruz Zendo. But actually what we're remembering now is this the story, the conceptual experience that's closely related to the confirmation, but it's not really the confirmation, right? But it's still useful. Just like this whole story now is a conceptual elaboration about something that can't be conceptually elaborated, but it might be useful to be able to like try to talk about this. That's what we say. It's like fingers pointing at the moon.
There's this sort of mathematical aspect of being in us that I think can be proved to be non-conceptual, which may serve at least inform this conversation, which is our breath. Which science, as far as I've understood it, and I think I probably read it in Asimov or one of these guys talking about, where in the pendular swing of the in and out breath momentum, when it hits a point of turning from one direction to the other, actually there's an impossible moment of infinity. can be described by mathematics of that switch of momentum.
Nice.
And in each of our breaths, that happens. That means we are present, and with each breath, we enter the infinite for some unimaginable moment.
I like that, yeah. You could say, what is it about the end of the in-breath or the out-breath that is like that? And maybe it's just because there's no movement at all. And there might be a more complex physiological explanations
for this. They convinced me, and it was fun to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so we are in the two realities always.
Yeah.
Breathing.
And that, you could say there's a non... It's a moment of non-conceptual, non-duality for a split moment. Just like the confirmation, am I aware right now, is like momentary confirmation, because momentary is like a moment in time, but it's like, it's an entry into the timelessness, is more accurate. Yeah. Just to add the last piece of this story, as I said, I would propose that this isn't really like an enlightenment experience. This isn't really verifying the Buddha's awakening, just to notice that we're aware right now. Although it's heading in that direction very closely, but what I would say, the non-conceptual, non-dual verification of Buddha's awakening is to first do these very two steps. Is awareness present right now? Confirm it. What is it that just confirmed that? It's the same light is confirming the light. And get used to that, and then, realizing immediately layers of conceptual thought get added on to this, but we can keep, it's a practice we can keep doing to kind of get used to it more and more over and over, billions and billions of times, to get familiar with this thing that cannot be grasped. And then, the more and more we can be this awareness, which we already are, but to knowingly be this radiant light, to rest as, abide as this light, even while there can be some conceptuality going on, because just to abide in this light with no conceptuality is very difficult to maintain, and maybe not even that important. The main thing is to be confirming it even while there's thoughts and experiences happening. And then these next steps that would be like approaching what we might talk of as Buddha's awakening is to then start exploring the implications of this ever-present light and the qualities of this light, or we could say aspects of it. Just the fact that we're aware right now is pretty cool to notice, because I would say it's rare to notice that because we're so object-directed. But then that doesn't necessarily free us from suffering. Yeah, I'm aware, but there's suffering going on here. And I'm identified with the suffering, and I'm identified with this particular impermanent body and mind and bundle of five skandhas we call suffering or not content, lacking something. So then this is the exploration. Once we're resting in this awareness, we can start to explore, is this awareness kind of prior to every experience? Is it not the source of every experience? Because it is what knows every experience. You can't have an experience without it, without this awareness, without the experiencing. So in that way, it's more fundamental, it's more primary, it's more basic than any experience ever could be. So our body and mind, I would call experience, is their particular events that we can know objectively in time and space, and therefore we remember them, and because they're graspable, we grasp them. Anything that is graspable, we will grasp as an object. That's how we're conditioned. So then part of what we do here is we back up, keep taking a step back and to the awareness and say, isn't this ever-present light more basic, fundamental, and prior to any experience we've ever had? And we can confirm that, I would say. Again, as Patrick said, we have to do a little conceptual reasoning, but then the non-conceptual confirmation of that fact can arise. And then we could say, well, then which seems more reasonable to identify as myself? The experiences of body and mind that are constantly changing, or the background that knows them all and is in a way prior to them? So then we're confirming this, we're shifting our identity through this exploration. We can shift our identity from its usual habitual thing of I am this body and these thoughts and these past memories and these emotions and all of this. That's who I really am. That one is impossible to ever be free. That one, this body and mind, cannot realize Buddha's awakening. Dogen says at one point, a person cannot realize awakening. Only a Buddha can realize awakening. So there's, what is it that's prior to the what we call the person? And then exploring how that one has no limits, no boundaries. These are conceptual questions that can lead us to a non-conceptual, non-dual verification of the boundlessness, ungraspability, beginninglessness, and endlessness. Not theoretical, but experientially. These are qualities of this present, this very same present awareness. But the awakening is more like awakening to its qualities. And particularly, you could say, if awakening could be defined as awakening to non-duality, then you could say, we can explore how, is the flower something other than the knowing of it? We can confirm that it's not separate. And then this issue of suffering or discontent, if that is our, if the freedom from discontent is awakening, then we can actually explore, is who I am, this awareness, is it free from suffering, even while the body and mind is suffering? And we can again directly verify there is one who is free, completely incapable of discontent, right at the same time as there's a body and mind that's lacking a whole bunch of stuff. So it's shifting the identity in this, which might seem like a contrived thing at the beginning, but we can come to confirm our true nature. So that's a story for today. That's a question? Yes.
So a while back now, you mentioned something about memory, or like the solidifying of the body and mind and time and space, mm-hmm. or something that we can remember or objectify.
Yeah.
And I was playing with this is awareness present exercise with memory. And you first asked the question, what we would call 20 minutes ago or something, asking myself, is awareness present? and then trying to remember, trying to like experience the memory of asking myself if the word was present 20 minutes ago, like it doesn't quite play out. Like, it doesn't quite work for me. In it with the same like vivid,
yeah,
you know, confirmatory,
yeah,
thought, mm-hmm, as if it's just now.
Exactly. That's why, like, any memory of some profound spiritual experience is so dull compared to right now. Right? It's so limited. It's an object. It's just an experience in memory. Yeah. Whereas the verification of the awareness and its awakened qualities of non-duality, also we can confirm the awakened qualities of love as an aspect of this ever-present knowing, and compassion, and because, and it's all-inclusive of everybody. There's no separation. So these are all aspects that we can explore, starting with a conceptual question and ending in a non-conceptual verification. And yes, it's the nice thing about it is it's always available, right? And if we ever try to go back to, and I think this is what commonly happens in spiritual practices, we have some special experience, and also this, as I said, you know, the non-conceptual confirmation leaves traces in the conceptual mind as a thought, but also it leaves traces in the body. Like the non-conceptual confirmation of radiant light, the body seems to relax more and feel more like at ease. And we're maybe sitting in a lot of pain, and then we kind of confirm this and like, it's actually all okay. This beings of light, are we? and so then we're registering it in a particular experience in the body, this lightness in the body, ease in the body, that I would call an experience, right? It's the traces of the reality of the light, you know, leaving these this impact on the body and mind, and we might even feel, and also the emotional, we might suddenly feel like very happy, and even ecstatic or joyful, or start crying even, you know. These are the signs, the marks that are left in the world of experience by something that's not an experience. And then we remember those because they're memorable, and we want to get back to those tears of joy and this easy body, like, how did I get that? Well, actually, those are just the signs and marks. Actually, those came from this confirmation that's available right now, but I better forget about the memory in order to find it now.
I was thinking about how Zen teachers very rarely talk about their own awakening experiences. I have heard a few and I've read a few. Usually they just touch on it lightly, and I think it's because they don't want to taint it with dualistic, with that I had that experience.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But it's interesting that a good teacher doesn't really refer to any of their own experiences in detail. Maybe just a touch if it feels like it would be beneficial.
Yeah.
But very carefully.
Mm-hmm. And there's different, you know, again, just different traditions around this. Like, I think Rinzai Zen tends to emphasize the dramatic signs of the non-conceptual verification, and celebrate them, Tangen Harada Roshi and his teacher in Japan. They were Soto Zen, but they had this Rinzai thing, Rinzai influence, and so they would, you know, people had this experience, and especially this emotional signs for this confirmation, and because there's a lot of push to get this in that tradition, then they would even, like, the end of Sesshin, they do like a celebration, like, OK, could everybody who recognized their Buddha nature in the Sesshin come and offer incense, you know? So, like, I think, in a way, I think, of course, that was probably meant to be encouraging, but I could see how it could be, like, extremely discouraging, too. I'm like, whatever they got, I want some of it. And Soto Zen and Dogen, his style is, I feel like Dogen's style, the Shobo Genzo, he's trying to speak from that place all the time to kind of like talk us into the place of boundless light. And so it's almost like being in it and not like, not emphasizing there was a certain time, explosive time. He did say something like, you know, I returned having completed my life's work. I returned from China to Japan. So it's kind of implying something happened that he went to complete and did complete. But even if some dramatic experience happens, then what's next? The idea is, I would say in a way, I think we can call this direct, non-conceptual, non-dual verification of these qualities of awareness, of that it's completely free from suffering, it's boundless, and it's not separate from anybody or anything else, those kind of qualities. I think that verification, we could call it enlightenment, we can call it awakening, but even then, it's not like the end of the story, it's kind of like the beginning of the story. Then we'd say, then there's the practice of continuing in this way, because it's just a, you know, we talk about like glimpses, and it's just a glimpse, and then the rest of our life between glimpses is just a bunch of habitual karmic patterns of like feeling separate from others, and like, so that's then becomes, how do we like keep checking back in a way you could say verifying over and over and over, but I already did that. Well, there's no end to this until we're like training the karmic person to be just like a continuous verification and continue to verify in more and more difficult situations. Like, I mean, that's what, like, Hakuin Zenji is like, I could verify this so easily in Zazen, but as soon as I got off the cushion, even, like, walking, I would lose it. I'm like, yeah. Much less an Orioki meal. Oh, man. Much less, like, talking. Oh, man. That's why we're in Sesshin. We're like, let's just put that one aside. That's way too complicated. Because it's inherently conceptual talking, right? But we want to be in the point, like the Buddhas, or who can be talking and still be verifying that who we are is this light. And it's just, we don't know who this is. But words can come out of it. And hopefully more and more the words that emerge from the light are more and more in accord with the light. Yes.
So, I would just say, we don't just fall back into our old ways, having gone through that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're tempered.
Yes, we're tempered.
And something does change.
Yes.
We've grown a little.
Yep. We are changed forever.
Yes.
And in a way, we can never go back completely. Some of these stories are in the sutras, even like a glimpse of a true reality is like, our habits are strong, so we can almost try to forget about it. And I think some people ironically do this, like, because it's actually, oh, I mean, that's who I am. I mean, everything that I've been completely invested in my whole life, of like all the activities of this body and mind, all these things that are just like for me, and all of that is like kind of an illusion, or was kind of is a misunderstanding. I don't know if I like the implications of this awakening. So let's try to forget that as quickly as possible. Pass me a beer. Quick, something. Like, let's, you know, binge on reruns of sitcoms or something. But I know this is, but like, the more and more I verify this light, the more and more I will, it will become my master. Like, it's the master of Shakyamuni and Maitreya. I will be its servant. And I don't know if I want to be its servant. I want to be an independent guy. I don't want to be a servant of the light. Like, be dragged around by Zazen. That's what Kodo Sawaki said. What could be more joyful than a life of being dragged around by Zazen? So yeah, we are changed, but our habits are still, can be strong, and they say, one model of, I'm not saying that this is exactly like the entrance to the Bodhisattva, the first Bodhisattva, Bhumi, but they sometimes talk about that as like this point of this change, or what they call stream enter in the early tradition. And there may be other qualities that is more than just a tiny glimpse that go with these noble descriptions of stages of practice. They may be more like a glimpse that's so powerful that like you cannot continue with the life that you were leading. Like it kind of like, it's instead of more like a tickle, it's more like a bulldozer glimpse. but at any rate, they sometimes say there's up to this point, this changing point that we could call a bulldozer or a mosquito. You could say three countless eons, three kalpas of kind of like devotional practice and staying on the cushion and just keep returning and letting go of distraction for eons. And then there's a shift. And then there's three more countless eons of integrating this into the rest of our life. And at the end of those three eons is what we call Buddha, where there's total continuity. We never fall back into identifying with a limited body and mind as ourself. That may be like unimaginable. Personally, I feel like it is almost unimaginable to be that like on all the time. But in fact, for me, anyway, it's not completely unimaginable. It's just almost unimaginable. Because if we can confirm this light, and confirm, then if that's how it is, then that's how it is, and that's how it can be, and there's nothing preventing this being 24/7 reality, except for just these eons of accumulated karmic patterns. So it's like a lot of work to, you know, retrain them. But now we're not retraining them based on like, I just gotta like try to avoid all these things that I like. Like this kind of self-imposed discipline. It's more like serving the light. And see how our new life emerges. Like, let the light take care of it.
May the force be with you.
May the force be with you.
Enlightenment stories, like why they're important and special, and why like they seem to imply that they kind of like only happen once, like
yeah.
in people's lives, and like if they happen to people and teachers that like do really sometimes like really terrible things later, and like it just like it's just kind of confusing to me. It's like why I guess I'm leaning. I guess this makes me, from a conceptual standpoint, want to lean towards this like so-called Soto notion of realization, because it's like I don't know. It seems like people have these experiences and then like don't always honor the precepts. For example,
yeah,
but just like well, wait, what are we talking about here? Like, why?
Yeah.
It sounds like kind of like maybe something pleasant happened, but like maybe very interesting.
Well, doesn't it make sense from this story that I just told of like. You can have this glimpse, and then of course you can break the precepts again, because because there's and you can say at the time of breaking the precepts, we're not in touch with our true identity, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But again, it seems to me like what's all the fuss kind of?
Like, well, I think it may be worth making some fuss, because you could say that is the key. If then we can serve that light. Then the precepts will take care of themselves. But the problem is, you can glimpse the light, but then not continue to serve it, and then continue to, like, I will be my own master, and then that's called the habitual self, small self, running the show. And so, of course, it's easy for me to see that. And I think in Zen, what often happens is people take that this momentary insight, which is true, authentic, it could be true, authentic verification and confirmation. And so that's the end. But that's like the beginning, or the middle, or something. It's not the end, until it's the end. But interestingly, one point about the precepts, which makes me think that something like stream enter, in the Theravada tradition, in the early sutras, as the first, they talked about the first non-conceptual direct confirmation of that I am, or you could say, that these body and mind is not myself, is how they word it there. They don't say, what is myself? That tradition will say, that what I thought was myself is not myself. And they say, the Buddha says, at that stream entry, one of the kind of like checking points of stream entry is thereafter, for the rest of that life, it's impossible to violate the basic precepts, like not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality, not lying. It's impossible. So in a way, that's a kind of a high standard glimpse. That's why it's a nice version of stream entry, you could say. So those who do continue those practices, those violations, you could say maybe that wasn't, it was a glimpse, but it wasn't the full entering the stream. Yes?
I remember my first teacher, Savannah, she was asked that question, and this metaphor fits really well with what you're talking about, and she spoke about. And this was in a sort of Rinzai mixed tradition, so there was a lot of sudden enlightenment types of conversations going on. The enlightenment is, you have the flame and the lamp, like a kerosene lamp, and if you don't do zazen and follow the precepts, the soot will just keep building up inside the glass until that light just gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer.
Mm.
And it never left me the way she described it, just as this sort of call to do zazen, follow the precepts, otherwise the soot will just build up and the light will never go out completely, but it will get very dim.
Mm.
And then she also made a point that we hear the stories of the teachers who falter and commit transgressions, but the vast majority don't.
Mm.
And I thought that was encouraging. We can hear the stories of teachers that fall from grace, but so many don't.
Mm-hmm.
They just
Another point that reminds me of is Dogen's Shusho Funi, practice and verification are not two. Shusho Funi. So practice and verification are not two. And Dogen critiques those who have this verification and say, now I've done that, so I don't need to sit anymore because I did it. Verification. But Dogen says, the verification only comes when we're practicing, and it's not a one-time thing. We have to keep practicing, and the practice, and also beautifully this emphasizes that the practice doesn't lead up to a verification at the end of practice. They're simultaneous. And practice here could mean zazen and precepts and basically anything that we're doing, doesn't have to be formal practice, anything that we're doing that's according with the light and remembering the light. But that the verification will not be verified if we're not serving the light. So before we adjourn, just a brief word from Ko and Ejo in the absorption in the womb of light. He quotes this other great story that some of us have heard, quoted by Dogen too, where great master Changsha said to the assembly, "The whole universe in 10 directions is the eye of a practitioner." Here he actually translates it as practitioner. And you might say, the whole universe in 10 directions is the eye or the light of everyone, but maybe pointing out that of a practitioner or a contemplative is saying, well, it is verified that the whole universe is our eye if we're practicing or contemplating. So the whole universe in 10 directions is the eye of a practitioner. The whole universe is the ordinary speech of a practitioner. The whole universe is the total body of a practitioner. The whole universe is one's own light, or go komyo, the light of the self. In the whole universe, there's no one who is not oneself. And then he doesn't comment much here. He just says, Ejo, commenting, says, "So, penetrating study of the way of the awakened ones requires diligence to learn and trust to realize. Unless you form an alliance with the family of Buddhas lifetime after lifetime, how can you grasp what you hear in a lecture like this? Make sure that you do not become further estranged and further remote from it." So here, I just hear it as, you must form an alliance with the family of Buddhas lifetime after lifetime. So I hear this as like, these are hard teachings to understand, especially for the conceptual mind. And we also need devotion. Forming an alliance with the Buddhas. And we have such practices like making offerings to Buddhas. I think of like maybe our quintessential offering in this lineage to form an alliance with the Buddhas is what we call Jukai, the ceremony of receiving the precepts. So it's a ceremonial alliance. So it's remembering that the precepts come forth from the radiant light, but it's also abhisheka, an initiation in forming an alliance with the lineage of all the Buddhas and ancestors. This is something inconceivable, I think maybe more emphasized in Japan, this devotional connection with the unbroken lineage of the awakened ancestors, and the ceremonial enactment of that confirms and verifies this alliance. So that's something beautiful that again, from the conceptual minds as well, it's just like one of those Zen ceremonies, but this is like one of the most beautiful seeds that can be planted in this world, I feel. And one last point about the precepts, since this is related. Edo quotes Shakyamuni Buddha from the Brahmajala Sutra on the Bodhisattva precepts and says, the light of lights, the actual sutra says, the precept light. But Edo says, the light of lights, creatively, quoting the sutra. It's not blue, yellow, red, white, or black. It's not form, not thought. It's not existent, not non-existent. It's not a phenomena resulting from causes. It's the source of all Buddhas, the basis of practicing the way of bodhisattvas, and the source, fundamental or origin of all the children or disciples of Buddha. And then Edo says, so the Buddha sat on this diamond throne of 1,000 lights and expounded the light of the one precept. So we have these bodhisattva precepts. Really, there's only one of them, which is we are not separate. And when we're not separate, we can't kill each other, and we can't steal from each other, and we can't sexually harm each other, and we can't lie to each other, and so on. And I think a great image for how conduct follows, a great metaphor for how conduct goes in accord with this confirmation of the light is, you know, the metaphor of the snake and the rope. It's such a great metaphor. We can use it again and again. In the dark, we're looking at, we come across a snake on the path, and we have a reaction to it. We have a body and mind response to seeing the snake. It looks like a poisonous snake. So our reaction is either fear, gotta get away from it, or aversion, let's kill it so we can, it doesn't harm us, or somehow, some negative emotion based on this, seeing the snake, right?
Or common sense.
Just avoid it.
Yeah.
It could be as...
Don't let them get hurt.
Yeah, well, to make the metaphor really juicy, right? If we may, when we see a snake like that, depending on our karmic tendencies, we may want to kill it or become terrified of it, and we'll do something with our body and mind, and our emotions will not be happy and content, right? And then we look closer. We look closer. We shine the light of knowing on this snake, and we see, actually, it's not a snake. It's just a rope. I thought it was a snake in the dark, but it's not a rope. So nothing changed. It's not a snake. It's not a snake. It's a rope.
Or it's not a rope.
Well, to keep going with this metaphor, it's in the light.
I'm sorry.
In the light, it's a rope. In the dark, in the darkness of ignorance, in this case, it's a snake. And then our reaction is different. It's like, the next night, we're going by and we see the same thing and it looks exactly the same as it did. but we have directly and non-conceptually confirmed and verified that it's not a snake, it's just a rope. So the next night, we have no emotional fear, we have no aversion, we don't want to kill the rope, we just walk right by it. How do we get bitten?
Because it's a snake this time.
So this time... Yeah, so in a way you could say that's why verifying once is not enough.
That's right.
We should...
Feather your camel.
If we come by the next time and you're like, well, that is in the exact same place as it was, but I confirmed yesterday that it was a rope. Let's verify it again. No harm in verifying it again. Let's not assume. Let's take out the light of wisdom again. Okay, it's cool. So I just think that's a beautiful metaphor for pointing out how conduct, the way we actually live in the world, is based on our perception of whether this is a snake or a rope, right? Nothing actually changes, it's just a shift of perspective. It's a shift of perspective. But the experience, the known experience, is completely different based on these two perspectives. Yeah. And the precepts are completely different based on this different perspective. And the way we relate to other reptiles is completely different based on this perspective. Okay. Sometimes with these Zen stories, it's like everything that comes in words is conceptual. But sometimes we get the conceptual, the non-conceptual light is transmitted right in the midst of conceptual words. That's amazing. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. So, any goodness and virtue and diligence and wholesome intentions, and especially any verification and confirmation, even the tiniest moment of verification, is the most precious gift. And easily lost, like a certain kind of fish eggs that die before they reach fruition, and flickering candle and a great wind. So before it's blown out, before these fish eggs, are scorched in the heat of the sun, let's offer them quick before they're gone to all beings throughout the universe so that they can be touched by this light. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.